that we get an opportunity to become better human beings, that fact makes me so grateful to be an alcoholic. And many people in my life are also very grateful that I know I'm an alcoholic today. The other thing is this, if you're new, or if you're, you know, new or used, whatever, I just want to say this, that my brother Kent C up in Ohio, he said this, and I believe it, that anybody, any alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic, any alcoholic who will grasp and develop our manner of living, who will, you know, incorporate these steps in their life as a way of life, that he's really never seen anybody who's worked these steps. Actually, I shouldn't say worked the step, taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and studied the traditions and lived within the concepts. So all three legacies actively in their life ever drink again. So if alcohol is a problem and you're an alcoholic and you want to experience loving joy and happiness throughout the remainder of your life, it's strongly suggested. No, don't you love that the big book on page 164 says our book is meant to be suggestive only? Wait a minute. You just saved my whole life here. What are you talking about? You know, and we realized we know only a little. What? You guys just mapped out the treasure for me and you're telling me you don't really know. Oh my goodness. But the good news today is that we're doing here today what Alcoholics Anonymous does best. One alcoholic talking to another. The bad news for me is I'm the one talking and I'm not listening. I'd much rather listen, but today I'm going to share my story with you. I come from a long line of alcoholics, both sides of my family. My father's side of the family was Cherokee and Creek Indian. They landed via Georgia through the Trail of Tears in the panhandle country of Oklahoma. He was raised for a while on a reservation before he was adopted. And my mother's side of the family were Scots-Irish, Western Europeans. Now, I mean, after that, I could probably just go into what it's like now. I mean, both of those nationalities don't have a fun time when it comes to booze, right? But I was born about 6 weeks premature. I barely weighed a couple pounds because of that, my lungs didn't fully develop. I still have bronchial issues, and that's why this COVID's got me kind of chained down and I'm really getting my money's worth out of Zoom. But because my lungs didn't develop, I had this chronic nagging cough. It was like a whooping cough that lasted. It would just go on all the time. Kept my parents up at night. And for them to rest, what they would do is they would heat up a tablespoon full of vodka and they'd throw a couple drips of honey or a little sugar in there to kind of take the bite out of it. And they'd bring that around the corner into me when I was in the crib now and say, here, honey, take this. It'll make you feel better. Oh, that warm vodka. Oh, makes me want some right now. You know, I mean, my bronchial tubes would dilate after that. I could breathe. I mean, I could rest and they could rest too. And you know what? I held on to that. Sorry about that. I got muted somehow. But I held on to that cough for a long time, and it got to where, you know, that didn't make me alcoholic, but it did implant a very firm belief that stayed with me a long time. Other things would make me feel better, right? Take this, honey. It will make you feel better. So, you know, growing up, I mean, another thing about alcoholism in my story is that it has a real fun phase to it. I mean, I had a lot of fun drinking. And, you know, as a kid, I was about, I think maybe 11, 12 years old. My mother thought that, she would, you know, make it possible for me to get a paper route, thought that would be a good idea. And, so, you know, that I was living with her and my stepfather in Seattle at that time. And my stepfather had a refrigerator in the basement that he kept full of beer. And this paper route was a early morning, the Seattle Post Intelligencer. And I remember I would sneak down to that refrigerator and throw four or five beers into my paper sack and head on down to the paper shack that morning. And, you know, a couple of the scallywags in there, other kids my age would, you know, kind of look over their shoulder and look at me and say, "Who's coming on the paper route with us today?" And I'd say, Anheuser. Or I'd say Carling or Schlitz, you know, whatever I had there. We'd chug those beers as fast as we could. And then, I mean, some days we'd dump the papers out. Some days I'd throw it up and break the screen door. Other days I'd deliver to the wrong house. I ended up getting fired from my paper route at 12 years old because we were drinking. I didn't put two and two together at that time. But boy, was my mom pissed that I had gotten fired from the paper route she thought was a good idea for me. And she didn't know it was behind the stealing of my stepfather's beer, but he kept scratching his head and wondering, what's happening? You know, cause he was a light drinker. He worked the swing shift. He'd come home, have two beers, eat some potato chips and watch the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. That was his big deal. And so his beer was disappearing faster than he was drinking it. He was a little suspicious. So, you know, as time went on, my parents had gotten divorced when I was little and I was still in that Seattle area living with my mom. And, a good buddy of mine was in the Boy Scouts and his father was a chef, a real well-known chef in the Seattle area. And we were going to this camp where we needed to get some merit badges, right? And we thought, hey, cooking merit badge. And so we were asking Donnie's dad, you know, and he says, "Hey, I can teach you guys how to make biscuit dough and cook these really good homemade biscuits over the campfire, smoky campfire biscuits. What could be better? And you guys can take some jam and honey and stuff up there with you." And we thought, you know, this is a good idea. So he taught us how to do it. And we get up there. We get to our camp. But what he didn't know and what nobody knew is that Donnie and I had gotten a couple of these mason jars lids off. And we were pouring different types of booze out of our parents' liquor cabinets into these jars. And we packed them in our gear that we went up there with. And when we were putting together our bread dough, we cracked those mason jars open and started having a few nips. And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I put alcohol in me, man, my personality all of a sudden comes alive. I change. You know, normal people, they get a little woozy. I don't get woozy. I accelerate. I get excited and I want more. And my buddy Donnie starts exploring around this little kitchenette area where we were making our dough at the camp. And he found a first aid kit. And in that first aid kit, there was a box of X-Lax beads. Now, you know, if you don't know, the beads are about 10 times more potent than the little chocolate squares. And I don't even know if they make that stuff anymore. But it is a very powerful laxative. We mix that stuff into the biscuit dough and we cooked these biscuits over the campfire and they were absolutely delicious. Now, I don't know because I didn't taste them because we were sitting around the campfire late at night and Donnie and I took one and threw it over our shoulder, act like we were eating it, chewing it up. And these camp counselors, there were five of them. And they must have eaten about four or five of them each. They loved the honey and the jam. And I'll tell you, this was like 1962, 63. They weren't airlifting a lot of people back then. But four of those counselors were airlifted right straight out of Camp Amachi because they had turned themselves inside out and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with them. So lo and behold, I didn't get my cooking merit badge. I didn't get the Star Scout Award, and I was really invited not to come back to that troop at that Lutheran church. So fired from the Boy Scouts. That's another, chalk that one up. I'm having fun now, though, you know, and that's the truth of it. I'm going through the fun phase. As I later on, I go to live with my grandmother in Eugene, Oregon. And, I'm going to high school down there. And, you know, in the 60s, you know, that was a very powerful time to be a young budding alcoholic. There were all kinds of non-conference approved materials rolling around. The Beatles were coming to America. Music was getting revolutionized. Things were really exciting. And I had a job in a little restaurant that was a few blocks from where I lived. And we would kind of take our time in the restaurant, and the owner would come back, and I had a buddy of mine that we went to school together. We were dishwashers, and, you know, he would say, okay, you boys lock up when you're done. So we'd take our time because we knew Don was leaving. And then we'd tap the keg and fill up these big old mayonnaise jars full of beer, and we ended up becoming pretty popular. And at that time, I mean, my alcoholism really hadn't progressed a lot. I was really enjoying and not really controlling, but enjoying my drinking. And I played on the baseball team at Sheldon High School in Eugene at that time in my sophomore year. But then all of a sudden they did something that was kind of beautiful to me at the time. Looking back on it, I think it's a curse for a kid like me. They did away with the grading system. It was going to be pass or fail. And they also did the same thing with attendance. They said, you know, and I thought, wow, I just hung up my baseball cleats. I said, I'm going to Fern Ridge Reservoir. We're getting kegs of beer. We're going water skiing. We're going to chase the girls. We're going to get drunk. Why play baseball? Right. And, it came time to graduate from high school, and the principal calls me into his office. He says, you know what, young man, you do not have enough credits to graduate, but we're going to say that you do, because you and all of your buddies, you get in trouble and you drag the whole student body with you. My senior year, we came up with a thing called Senior Skip Day. Now, they don't take attendance. No, but we all met in this gigantic park at Armitage Park, right on the McKenzie River. And we met there in the morning. This was to be an all day event. I stole a couple gallons of wine from that little restaurant I worked at. And, the last memory I have of that event was about 75 of us sitting in a gigantic circle. And I pop one of those gallons of wine, and I'm drinking that. There was some of that non-conference approved stuff was getting thrown around, and I black out. I don't remember anything. The next thing I know, my feet are freezing cold, and I come to consciousness, and I'm totally naked with my feet in the edge of the McKenzie River in the sand. And I look, and there's nobody around. And I kind of look behind me, and my clothes are neatly hung up on the bushes up off the shoreline. And my buddy John is way up in a tree, and he's, you know, kind of passed out in the fork of this tree. I thought, what the hell? So I mean, I'm kind of self-conscious a little bit. I mean, I jump up, run up there, get into my skivvies and get dressed again. And I'm thinking, God, I missed the whole damn party. And I'm thinking, now how am I going to get him out of that tree? I don't want to shock him or he might fall down. I'm throwing these little pebbles and pine cones up there. And finally he goes, oh my God. And so I'm, hey, get down there. The first thought that comes to our mind, we got to go get some beers. We missed the whole party, you know? So I'm still having fun. You know, we end up, I'm involved in the very final draft for the Vietnam War. I had registered for the draft. Now, I was protesting that war. There was a lot of that going on in Eugene. Students for a Democratic Society and Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden, they were all over that campus. And, I mean, I had hair then. I mean, I had hair that looks like Pete's in Chicago. It was way down the back of my back. And I'm protesting this war. We're going all over the place, raising hell that this is wrong, and hell no, we won't go. A group of us tried to run away from home. We were going to go to Mexico and live off the land. I didn't know how to live on the land, let alone off the land. I mean, I didn't know it. I was living with my grandmother, for crying out loud. And we didn't even make it, you know, 50 miles. We were fighting. And, you know, I mean, thank goodness we didn't make it. We'd end up dead down there. But I come back home and my grandmother tells me the draft board's been looking for me. So I'm thinking at the time it was a popular thing, if you were a conscientious objector, you were against that war, to run away and go to Canada. And I was really, really thinking that was a good idea until I talked to my father. He told me, he says, you know, son, don't do that. Please don't do that. You know, you're going to renounce your citizenship. We don't know if we'll ever see you again. Why don't you think about this? I know a Navy recruiter in Seattle up where your mother lives that can get you out of your trouble with the draft board. You can enlist in the United States Navy, and, you know, they've got fresh, warm food every day. You got a roof over your head, and the girls like the uniforms. I thought, oh, the girls. Girls like the uniform. Maybe, you know what? I think that is a good idea. So I enlist in the Navy, and the first place I go after boot camp is to an old destroyer that was in the shipyard. It was a World War II class destroyer that was getting refurbished. And they sent us right off the coast of Da Nang to draw enemy fire. That's a comforting thing. But in the barracks where that ship was getting refurbished, they had like a soda machine, but it dispensed Schlitz malt liquor. Boy, did I like Schlitz malt. I like 100 proof whiskey, Schlitz malt liquor. That's a great recipe for me. So for 25 cents, we get a can of Schlitz. And, I like the barracks life, actually. And, you know, but our ship took off. We went over to the West Pacific, and it was getting, you know, we spent about 14 months over there. We came back home, and, they were taking volunteers to come to Portland, Oregon to train reserve sailors. And I had family in Seattle, you know, family in Eugene, family in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I thought, yeah, man, Portland's good. So I'm knocking on the door. I'm volunteering for that. And I get accepted for that. The ship comes to Portland. There was no Navy here. In fact, they have a thing here called the Portland Rose Festival. Portland's the city of roses. And during that event, these ships come and dock along the seawall on the Willamette River. And, you know, they had a thing called Dial a Sailor. Young women could call this hotline and get dates with sailors, you know. I mean, I thought, this is heaven. San Diego at the time, they were throwing things at us, spitting on us. We were baby killers. They were really against anybody in the military. But Portland was my kind of town. So, you know, I ended up renting a little house in North Portland. And it had this gigantic clawfoot bathtub in this old house. And my favorite pastime of an afternoon was to fill that thing with as hot a water as I could stand and have a cooler full of ice cold beer, soaking in that hot water, drinking that ice cold beer. Oh my God. It doesn't get any better than that. Oh, that, wait a minute. That's old Milwaukee, you know, but I wasn't drinking that. I think I was on the Heidelberg at the time. I was getting fond of the German beer. It really wasn't German beer. But anyway, at one of those days, one of those afternoons, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, I get a call from a buddy of mine. Steve calls. He says, hey, there is a dance at the University of Portland right now. Three girls for every guy, live music, and 10-cent beer. I went, 10-cent beer? Man, for $5, we could get off. So come over and get me. So we go over to this dance. And we just get hammered. We're just sloshed. And I don't know about any of you women, but when somebody comes up and says, would you like to dance? You're probably not too excited about that. So my alkalogic kicks in, which it has a habit of doing after about 10 or 15 beers. And it tells me, Akina, and I tell Stevie, I go, Steve, great idea. I'm going over by the women's restroom. A good looking one comes by. I'm a tripper. Save her life and ask her to dance. He says, I got to see this. So we go wandering over there. And here comes this fine looking woman. Tripped her. Saved her life. You almost cracked your head open. Would you like? She goes, well, I was on my way to the restroom. Can I go in there first? And actually, I got to tell you, that's how I met my wife. And we, this past June, celebrated 44 years of marriage together. Now, not all of my alkalogic ideas have worked out so well, but that is one fantastic accident that has turned out impeccably beautiful, I got to tell you. So as it goes, you know, I'm all hot to get married. I mean, I am love at first bite here. And she is like, whoa, hold on a minute, Tonto. We don't know about this right now. Why don't we do this? We're going to hang out together for about 6 months because we love hanging out and doing things. I mean, she could drink a little bit, but she really had trouble keeping up. I had to throw her over my shoulder several times, haul her out of the saloon. And she says, if we feel the same way in 6 months, then we'll get engaged for 6 months. And within that period of time, we can plan our wedding. And I told her my idea of a wedding. She started kind of crying and sniveling a little bit because her family is of Italian descent and she had been planning her wedding with her father and her grandparents since she was a little baby girl. And it was a big, big, big deal. And so, okay. And I was told, suit up, show up. That's it. Say your lines. That's all you don't have anything else to plan, you know, buy the ring. And so we ended up engaged and we got married. It was about, I think it was about 4 years into that marriage. Our first child was born. And during this time, I'm drinking and my alcoholism is starting to pick up a little speed. I'm kind of becoming a daily drinker now. I mean, I love the cracking of the cold beer the moment I get home. And, you know, I needless to say, what happens when I was growing up, when you have a child, I mean, you get drunk and give everyone cigars, right? And I was just hammered when my son was born, I burned a hole with a cigar in our couch and I had to flip the pad over. I ended up getting caught on that. But anyway, I was there for the birth of those children, but I was there. I really wasn't there. And so now I've got these two little babies. We about 17 months after our son is born, our daughter's born. And, you know, I'm trying to keep up with being a decent parent, but, you know, my wife, to be honest, is doing most of the work, making most of the decisions. I'm like another kid, right? And I didn't come to you until our children were 8 and 10 years old. And at that time, I had been engaged in some activities that I'm highly ashamed of. I mean, it got to the point through the course of their lives where I couldn't drink the way I needed to. My alcoholism has now progressed to the point where I'm drinking every moment, every day that I can get away with it. And I can't put too many hours together without putting booze in my system. It got to where it was hard for me to dress it up and take it to town anymore. I mean, in the morning, I would swear off every morning because I was violently ill. I would turn up the radio in the bathroom when I'm in the shower, because I didn't want to hear everybody hear the noise of all my insides and even leaving the nearest exit of my body and the horrible me gasping for air in there. I'd get out of the shower. I couldn't dry off. I kept sweating. I was about as red as my tie. My eyes didn't look the same direction. I looked like the Budweiser chameleon. I couldn't carry on a straight conversation. And there were times when I wasn't even coming home after work, because it would start to be a phone call here and there. Well, we really got some important business going on down here at the saloon. I really, you know, I'll be late. And then, you know, late comes and I'm called. Well, I'm still here. You know, she gets fed up with this pretty early on, but it's sustained. It happens all. And now I'm just not calling. I'm just not coming home. And they're not thrilled about that. They're obviously, you know, when it says in the relationship inventory, did you ever arouse suspicion? Yeah, daily. How about anger? Oh yeah. You know, when I get home, finally, they're not all out gathered on the porch. Oh, great. Daddy's home. No, there's some very important questions that need to be answered. And if they're uncomfortable conversations for a guy like me, questions like, where have you been? Who have you been with? Are you drunk again? What is wrong with you? And I don't know about you, but I mean, when I lived with my grandmother after my parents first got divorced, there were 5 boys and 2 girls already there. Now my 2 brothers and myself, 8 boys and 2 girls, and the stuff trickled downhill. And with little boys that are smacking each other, it's hurt people, hurt people, hurt people. The youngest one, my little brother Philip, he starts screaming before it even got to him because he knew he was gotten a licking coming. And so my defense mechanism is a violent reaction. And I start punching holes in the wall and I'm screaming and yelling at her. She's barely 5 foot tall, 110 at that time. She's not too far off that right now. And I mean, I'm looming over her and yelling at her and trying to defend my right to drink. Under the pursuit of the effect produced by alcohol, I've now pushed my entire family across the bar. And I'm ashamed to admit this. I mean, there were a couple of instances, probably 2 or 3 that I'm aware of, where she came at me on some of these questions and needling me and intensely angry, where I'm like, leave me alone. And I'm putting my hands on her. I'm striking my wife in front of my children in an alcoholic battle over my right. My national anthem was, leave me the hell alone. get off my back. If you work like I worked, if you come from where I come from, if you do it, you deserve, I deserve, I'm, here's the big lie. I'm not hurting anybody but myself, you know? And where I was raised, that if you laid your hands on a woman or you abused a child like that, you deserve to go right to the front of the line at the guillotine, or you get to stand in front of the firing squad. You need to be executed. It's a horrible, horrible crime. But here I am. That's me. You're looking at knee walking, commode hugging, wife beaten drunk. That's me. And so my wife's family got together, called the AA hotline, and arranged for a little bit. I think it could be referred to maybe as a mini intervention, because none of them wanted to take part in it, but they got my wife to give me what was an awkward invitation to come to you. It was one of those, you need to get help or get out of here. We can't watch you kill yourself anymore. And she had made an appointment with a counselor. Now, I thought I was a marriage counselor. We've been to a few of those based on my shenanigans. And, you know, the last time we went to one, they asked me, you know, how much do you drink? I go, well, what does that got to do with anything? You know, I mean, we're here for our marriage. Well, we heard that you drink quite a bit. Yeah, I'm telling them, well, I can take it or leave it. I just choose to take it right now. I can leave it alone and let you help me. It was about 3 days in. My wife comes home. I'm drinking a cold beer. She says, hey, what are you doing? Are you drinking? I said, you know, this is beer. Beer doesn't count. I want you to know what I found out. Beer counts. Okay. So we're at this counselor, and he starts talking about how the tremendous shame over his conduct, the fear that he had, the separation from the world and the loneliness that he felt, the tremendous anxiety and depression that he suffered from. I got pissed at my wife. I start turning at her. He goes, hey, wait a minute. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about me. Here happens the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's talking about his drinking, and I identify with that. Now, many people had told me, you need to stop it. Get off the hard stuff. Why do you do that? Look at the family you've got. You're ruining it. I mean, but now when I identify with him, all of a sudden I have this experience where I'm like, thank God I'm not the only one that's acting like this. I'm not the only one that has this problem. And now I'm willing to admit that I've got something wrong with me that he happens to know about. So now I'm willing to take a suggestion. After that meeting with him, it turns out he was a counselor at the hospital I ended up going to treatment. I didn't know it at the time. And his final suggestion was, you should go take an intake interview over there. I can arrange that for you. But, you know, I go home with this spiritual experience of identification, and I'm pouring everything down the drain and flushing the toilet a few times. It was about 3 hours later. I'm going, oh my God, what did I do that for? But I detoxed at home. I couldn't get into that treatment center till after the 4th of July. I have a special fondness for anybody that can't quite make the holiday on their sobriety date. I couldn't make the 4th of July. My sobriety day is June 25th. But by the time the 4th of July was over, I had detoxed pretty well. I mean, I was having visual and auditory hallucinations. I went and bought a bunch of insecticide, sprayed our whole bedroom. I thought bugs were crawling on the bed. My kids are like, Daddy, there's no bugs in here. What are you doing? You know, I just had a hell of a time. And that first sober 4th of July, I really don't even want to call it sober, but I was abstaining. I mean, everybody's smiling in their 4th of July shirts, and I'm in the back row. I mean, I was beat up bad. It really hurting. And we still have that picture up in the hallway. That's a great reminder for me. But as it goes, that treatment center did a very valuable thing for me. I mean, I went in there and lied to them. They said, how much do you drink? I came up with some crazy answer. But they already had the book on me, because this guy had intervened in my life and knew a lot about what I was doing. So they let me in. And I think the first time I identified with that little treatment group that I happened to be in, I think I said, my name's Rick, and I think I'm chemically dependent. They all went, ah, go over there and sit with Tom the heretic. There was a guy, my buddy Tom, he showed up to the treatment center, and he wanted them to sign a certificate that he was not an alcoholic so that she couldn't get him in the divorce for drinking. And so, okay, I think we got a chair for you too. Come on in here. And he introduced himself as Tom the heretic. He didn't believe it. He didn't want it. We ended up both getting sober. But that treatment center did a valuable thing for me. They gave me about a $2,500 big book, but they also made it a requirement that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was there that I bumped into an old guy with a white cane, an old blind man, a former Marine who happened to be the Western United States champion. He worked for a wine company here. He sold more Thunderbird wine than anybody in the western half of the U.S. I think he drank a lot of his own samples. And the late, great Jack Kimball was my first sponsor. He gave me a card when he bumped into me, or when I bumped into him, said, "Here, kid, take this. Give me a call sometime." I take that card back, and I give it to the treatment center. "Hey, I got a sponsor." Then I thought, oh, my God, wait a minute. What if the treatment center police call and check with him? So now I got to tell Jack that I've said he's my sponsor, and he's blind. He goes, "Oh, great, you can pick me up, give me a ride." So I'm driving him around and going, "Look at that." He goes, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Rick, I can't see. Don't tell me. Tell me what you're looking at." You know, and I get very fond of Jack Kimball, like you can't believe. But he did some tricky things. He takes me with him to a treatment center, introduces himself, talks for a few minutes and says, "And I'm sure you felt that too." He goes, "Rick, tell him how you feel about that." I'm like, "Oh my God," you know, so he put me into service right away. I became the secretary. My first commitment at that day, it was a daily noon meeting where he was. And my first commitment was washing the ashtrays. God bless Melissa. She taught. I'm not doing it right. I was just wiping them out. I had to soak them in the water. I had to wash them and dry. I mean, there was a method to the commitment. I had to follow that. Then I became a coffee maker. And after about, I think it was pretty close to a year, Jack had gotten me through an inventory. Since he was blind, I tried to fake my inventory. I wrote a bunch of crap that I didn't think he could see. And he had this monocle that he could actually, he was legally blind, but he could see if he looked through it. He wrote in red ink on there, "What the F is this?" And he gives it. I thought, oh my God, if he lets the treatment center know about this, they'll send me back to treatment. You know, don't fire me. Stay my spot. You know, I'll do it. So I ended up doing an inventory. Now I got to tell you, that first inventory, it wasn't a neatly constructed four column thing with all the, but it was from my heart, and it was very meaningful and very self revealing and self searching. And that's all it took at that time. And that group was saying things like, "Just work a step a year." I mean, Jack told me, no, that's not for you. He says, "That's like if you got a case of the crabs and I got the blue ointment, I'm not letting you wait a year before I give it to you. You'll scratch the bones right off your body. You're taking these steps now." So thank God that I remember coming up to him and saying, "Oh, I'm just so afraid. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my wife. I'm going to lose my kids. I was like the lawnmower that couldn't get going. I'm going to. He says, "Hey, shut up." He actually shook me. "Shut up. You're going to lose all, you deserve to lose that stuff. Look at the way you've treated it. Let's get into these steps." So, but by this time, after about a year, close to a year, I'm at steps 8 and 9, and I've just destroyed a family. I mean, I've just whittled this family down to a bone, and I don't know what to do, how to, you know. And we had a meeting every Sunday. This home group had a meeting where it was just home group members only. And they were talking about step 11. And my sponsor had kind of been on me about these amends, and especially with my family. And, you know, but when we were talking about step 11, there's a little section in there that says, "Never are we to pray for ourselves unless it's to be of use to others." And my sponsor told me, "You know what, just go home. Get in a comfortable place. You have a comfortable place?" I go, "Yeah, I've got a recliner that I like." He goes, "Get in that recliner. Sit back." And he had me doing a little bit of, "Please keep me sober in the morning. Thank you for keeping me sober in the afternoon." They're not the prayers in our literature, but they were working for me. I was using them. And I was also doing some breathing. As I breathed in, I would say, "The Spirit of God is within me." And as I slowly exhaled, I'd say, "Oh, the grace of God surrounds me." And he says, "I want you to do that breathing and relax." As I'm sitting in that recliner, "The Spirit of God is within me. Oh, the grace of God surrounds me." And then I just said, "You know what, God, if you're real, if you're there, if you're listening, it's me again, you know, and I need to know what I can do to save this family. I don't know what action can I take to save this family that I've ruined." And right then, and I mean, I used to blame my wife for everything. I would say, If you were a better mother, you ask these kids to do crap and you wait till the 15th time you ask them before you make them do it. If you pull your head out of your backside and get them to behave, we wouldn't have a, but in that moment after that prayer, I hear this fight going on in the back of the house. It's my son and my wife going at it. And I had what we sometimes refer to here as a moment of clarity where into my mind, I think, oh my God, it's not her. That's not even him. That sounds like the way he's seen me talk to her. I have taught my son, this is the way we do business with the women that we love. This is the way we treat beautiful women with anger, you know, with mean-spirited words, you know. And the kids went to bed and I pulled my wife over to my side and I said, you know what? I had this epiphany. I've just got to tell you, the problems that our children have nothing to do with you. You're a phenomenal mother. It's on me. They've learned their shenanigans from me. I thought she was going to faint because I'm a blamer. I'm not, but in this moment, what a moment of clarity for me. And then, but when I got that answer before I pulled her aside, I'm saying, okay, God, this is not the answer I'm looking for here. What am I going to do about this? And the idea comes into my mind, well, you kind of like going to these AA meetings. Why don't you call a family meeting? And so I thought, okay. So when I'm telling my wife this, she looks like she's going to faint. And then I throw another one on her. I go, and I'd like to have a family meeting tomorrow morning. She goes, what? What are you going to talk about? I go, I don't know. I don't know. Isn't it great in Alcoholics Anonymous? We don't need to know, you know. In fact, we ask to set aside everything we think we know, right? And so that night when I'm getting ready to hit my pillow, I'm saying, God, I don't know anything about what this meeting is going to turn out like. I don't know what the words are going to be. Thank you so much for revealing to me the problem and keeping me sober. But I'm really going to call on you a little early here. I need some words tomorrow, man. I'm going to need you to really come alive with me. And so that following morning we had breakfast and we all gathered in the living room. And I remember I set it up just like a group conscience. I said, you know, this is just, we can call these meetings anytime. We don't interrupt anybody. We only talk one at a time. We let each other say what we need to say. We can call a meeting like this to plan a vacation. If you have any kind of a grievance or any kind of a problem, you call a meeting. We can all come together. And then the magic really starts to happen because I hadn't premeditated any of this. And what came out of my mouth was, how do you think baby animals learn? My 8-year-old daughter, Shannon, raises her hand. I know, Daddy. She goes, it's like on the animal show. The mama tiger is being rough with the baby and teaching it how to be tough and survive and teaches it how to hunt. And it's like monkey see, monkey. I go, that's right. And I said, but you know what, Shannon Lynn, I've been a bad monkey. And my son's over there shaking his head. Yeah. And I said, and I referred to my time with you. I referred to Alcoholics Anonymous as taking classes. I said, but I'm taking classes right now to learn how to be a better monkey. And then I said, you know, the sad thing, here's some more magic. I said, the sad thing in our family, we can't even say that we love each other right now in our family. And my son raises his hand. He goes, Dad, I got an idea. I said, okay, Ricky, what's that? He goes, well, there's a group of us that ride our skateboards. We had this, it was a Tony Hawk death defying before the, you know, things that he rode on. It was a hill and kids would damn near get killed, right? He said, we ride our skateboards all over the neighborhood and we kind of have a secret code language that we talk in. Why don't we make a secret code thing that means I love you? I'm like, wow. I mean, I looked over at my wife and she's worrying. She just got confused as I am right now. And I said, okay, what would that be? What would that secret code thing be? And he said, we're going to say snow bunnies live on Mount Hood means I love you. And I thought, yeah. So we gather together, hold our hands. We say the Lord's Prayer and everybody chants snow bunnies live on Mount Hood and we break away. And I was just freaked out. I thought, oh my God. And what really freaked me out was about a week and a half later when I came home, my wife is in the kitchen and she's crying, fixing something for us to eat. And she's not just crying. I mean, she's got, and I'm asked her, I go, what's wrong? She goes, Ricky just came up, tapped me on the shoulder and said, Mom, snow bunnies live on Mount Hood. And I thought, holy cow, what did I do? What have I done? I abandoned myself to God as I understood God. And I don't understand him today. I prayed for my family, not for myself, right? And those actions led to those things. That was the very beginning of my realization that I had made contact with the power far. If you're real, if you're there, it was listening. Guess what? He was real. It was there. It was listening. And a powerful thing began to occur. The love that I had stolen from that family for 10 years was beginning to be restored in those moments. It was about a few weeks after that, maybe a month after that, my little girl, Shannon wants to call a family meeting. We're all like, oh my God, what for? Because when she was 3, she came downstairs one night in her little onesie and told us, we're making too much noise. If you don't cut it out, you know, I don't have to live here. I'm like, what? Where are you going to go? You're only 3 years old in your onesie, for crying out loud. I told my wife when she's 16, man, we better be well armed and ready, because I don't know what's going to happen. But her complaint was, Ricky gets to pick all the words. He gets to decide everything. I want to change the word. I go, okay, what do you think? And Ricky says, yeah, I don't care. She goes, I want it to be squirrels have fuzzy tails. Now means I love you. So that became the next word. And, I mean, you know what? I got to just tell you this. Shannon Lynn was absolutely right. It is monkey see, monkey do. It's the same thing here. If there's anyone new here, I just want you to know something. I want you to find the monkeys that know where the bananas are here. There are monkeys in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't even eat the bananas. All right. This group has got some good monkeys in it. Not all groups do. Not all meetings do. Not all places do. Find a monkey that you can trust and have them show you where the bananas are at. You know, I want to thank this group. Oh, this is hard. From the bottom of my heart, I'm having a tough time right now. I just got news that a sponsee that I had for the last 6 years passed away last Tuesday from pancreatic cancer. He's only 45 years old. And I want you to know that my friend Woody, for some God unknown reason, he came to our group and he was drawn to me and he got close with me, which enabled me to get close with him. And in the midst of our closeness to one another, God was there with both of us. And, you know, my friend Howard Poland used to say, you know what? Find the window or the passageway where there's God for you and go and sit in that window, experiment and play in that passageway. You know, and I the question that I've come up for myself and for each of us tonight is like, you know, how willing are we to get closer to God? I've just described a phenomenal experience with the love coming back to my family. My wife and I are together 44 years because of that beginning. I've had tremendous spiritual experiences since then. And my children are my best friends, and my granddaughters are the apple of my eye, and we have a wonderful life together. But I have spiritual amnesia, and sometimes, listen to this, I get busy. Sometimes there are things that seemingly are more important than my relationship with God. You know, the passage of my good, dear, loved one, Woody, has brought closer to my heart how important it is for me to cherish every moment with each of you and with those I really love. And, you know, the late, great Lynn Wilder always wrapped up his talks with this. He said there was an elegant Swiss watchmaker that made a special pocket watch that survived many generations of a family. And everybody would always ask, how does that thing keep working for all this time? And it was the person that owned it that opened up the cover and looked inside. And there was a little inscription in there that said, when broken, return to maker. My pal Woody Malone was broken just enough that he was returned to his maker. And I'm so grateful to have known and loved him. And I'm going to dedicate all the good I do in my recovery and the love I can bring to y'all and to people in the world to his loving memory. And so I just want you to all know I love all of you with all my heart. And I know I'm going to do a better job staying closer to God. I'm going to spend a little more time in that window Howard described. God bless each and every one of you. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to me today.